episode 184, recorded November 5th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Hello, we are back.
Yes.
As this is doing a little
previously
better.
Implied. I am doing a little better, yeah. Much better, actually. Not
well, if
great.
I have a coughing fit in the middle, or he has a coughing fit in the middle, you'll have to excuse us.
We're going to try to pause it so that doesn't happen. But anyway, here we go.
We'll cough away from the microphone.
Yes. The show is about to start. Who do we have lined up this week?
We have David from Colorado, which I think he's new, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And a different David from the website.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a different David?
It's a different David.
Okay. And Dr. Bob, we're going to finish his...
From the North Shore of Boston.
Yes. We're going to finish Dr. Bob from the North Shore of Boston's email from last week.
And then he has another submission after that.
Yeah, so we get two Dr. Bobs. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Anthony in Oregon and Tony in New York.
Yep.
Although before we get started,
mm-hmm.
we should... We can't do like a thermometer that we fill up because, you know, it's
auditory. We don't
auditory.
Have any thermometers.
But we're up to about $135.
$135, yeah. And one of our donators was David in Colorado.
So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. To all of our donators, or mm-hmm. those who have contributed to the Field Recorder Fund.
We're excited.
And we're getting real close.
Yep.
We need a few more donations and we'll be getting that field recorder. And then we won't have to both try to shout into one microphone.
Yeah, because isn't that fun?
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, or the iPad like we're doing now.
In fact, we were just saying we should... I mean, this is episode 184. We're coming up on 200. It would be really cool if we had the field recorder so we could do something really cool for episode 200.
I think we could do that because that's 16 weeks.
See?
We can do it way before
that. We
can totally
do that. Yeah. Okay. Excuse me. Okay, so we're going to go to the second David.
Mm-hmm. This is David K.
Who sent a message on the website.
Yes, so we don't know where he's from.
Yes, he's Cyber David.
Okay.
He says, I just found out about your podcast and I'm starting to catch up on old episodes. Sorry, guys. I recently listened to your interview with Diana Wahlstedt, and when you guys were talking about aquarium gloves, I thought about these. And he sent in a link.
From Amazon.
Mm-hmm. He says, these are used by large animal vets when checking cows for pregnancy. They are thin, disposable, cheap, and they go all the way up to your shoulder.
So that could be a good alternative to the
Well, you know, I think gloves. Especially the fact that they're disposable, if there's something in your tank that you don't want to, you know, possibly cross-contaminate a different tank with.
Right.
Do you want to use its own pair of gloves that you can just toss afterwards?
Right.
That's a good idea.
It is a great idea. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing.
And we'll put the link up.
Yeah, we will.
Okay.
And thank you for joining us, because I think this is the first time that David K. has joined us.
Yes, I think so. Both of those Davids are new Davids.
Yes. So thank you, David in Colorado, for contributing.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, David in...
Cyberspace
for telling us about these gloves.
Okay, so we're going to finish Dr. Bob's email from last week.
Mm-hmm. And this was about the water change topic we talked about a few episodes ago.
Okay. He says, the recent podcast topic on water changes gave me something new to worry about. Thanks a bunch. I read the two articles. Thanks for the link. I was previously thinking that my 20% weekly water changes would be good enough for my 55-gallon tank. I could manage a 10-gallon change with two buckets to outgas and treat the water before replacing the water siphoned out during the substrate cleaning. I don't even want to think about the time and effort it will take to outgas, treat, and replace water to 70 to 80% level. Maybe I need to dig a well to do a flow-through system. Yeah, right. How in the world do people who have large aquariums treat their water for 70% water change prior to placing it in the aquarium? I know that there are people who treat the water after it has been added to the tank, but I know that this kills beneficial bacteria and can crush your system, especially if it is a huge water change. Shall I go on, or do you want to comment?
Go ahead and go on, and I'll comment after.
Okay. But before I go off the deep end, I have some thoughts. As for the science behind the articles, the hypothesis is that crud builds up at a faster rate than a daily 10% water change can handle. The parts missing in this hypothetical research are, one, the nature of the crud or dissolved organic matter that we are concerned about, and two, the actual parts per million of dissolved organic water prior... dissolved organic water.
I thought you said matter.
Sorry, no, I said water.
Oh, okay.
Okay, let me try that again. Two, the actual parts per million of dissolved organic matter prior to a water change and after a water change at each consecutive daily cycle. Absent those definitions and measurements, we cannot determine if, in fact, the amount of dissolved organic matter increases over the period of time, say a month. We also have no idea if the level of dissolved organic matter would ever reach a detrimental level during that period. The writer of the article may have been using good math, but I question his science. I would like to see some good empirical studies using scientific methods we can trust, not simply the math of percentages and anecdotal evidence involving a flow-through system with some Oscars. Okay, so he's saying the guy who did these articles didn't actually check and see how much stuff is in the water before and after.
He approached it kind of a theoretical matter, saying, for example, let's just say that there are X units of crud in the tank, mm-hmm. and we're not going to be concerned about what types of crud they are mm-hmm. and everything. And assuming that, this is what the graphs would look like. That's kind of the approach he took. Okay.
But he didn't actually check it.
Right.
Okay. Okay, so Dr. Bob continues, I could not find much information as to David E. Baruchowicz's...
I have no idea how to really I'm pronounce sure that. I'm
sure I just totally butchered that. I'm sorry, Mr. B.
Baruchowicz? I don't know.
Baruchowicz, that's probably better. Training, only that he has kept fish for over 50 years and is the editor-in-chief of Tropical Fish Hobbyist magazine. His years of experience may be impressive, but his science is lacking any controlled empirical evidence. His article would never pass a peer review for a scientific journal. I know the difficulty I have had in publishing research studies. My point, just because it is published does not make it authoritative. So before I go off thinking I must spend hours per week doing huge water changes, I think I need to see some real research on this topic. I'll do that in my spare time. I'll tell you if I find something. Great show last week. I appreciate a longer show, especially when it makes me reconsider my current ideas and practices.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Bob.
So is this, like, going to be our project for the kids' science for this year?
I don't know. They'd probably try to kill me if I suggested that. No, but I don't know if they'd want to do that. But I think it is an important, some important points he brings up. Some excellent points, in fact. Certainly, it was not a peer-reviewed journal. Tropical Fish Hobbyist is a great magazine, but it's not a peer-reviewed journal, and as such does not have the, quite the rigor that a peer-reviewed journal would have. But I have some thoughts relating to your thoughts. First, I think... it's fairly easy for me, at least, to accept, and I think a lot of aquarists, to accept that frequent large water changes are beneficial for the fish, just knowing that we're giving them all this fresh water and removing all this waste, preventing them from having to deal with all this waste and come in contact with it, right? As long as the pH and the outgassing and issues like that are dealt with. But I think the big question here is whether or not such big water changes are practical or necessary. And that's where it comes down to, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing it mentioned in the article is that systems vary. You know, the aquarium system varies, and the need for water changes vary with the system. It talked about, like, you know, a planted tank with the low bio load doesn't need as many water changes because it's converting a lot of crud to plant matter. And
the plants are cleaning it already.
Right. They're exporting that crud by converting it to plant mass. And so a 20% per week change on a tank like that, in combination, in conjunction with this large conversion of crud into plant mass, may be enough because that the crud is no longer building up at near the rate that it would be in another situation. And you look at tanks like this, that are getting 20% per week water changes, and a lot of them house beautiful fish that live long lives, reproduce prolifically, and if that's not a measure of health, you know, non-empirical, although it is, that's a pretty good measure of health. If you have thriving fish that are living a long time and reproducing well,
that's what you want.
And they're not getting huge water changes. You know, some of them are, but many of them are not.
I guess you could say they're not getting water changes done by people.
Yeah, it's not so much water changes as nutrient export.
Right.
Nutrient conversion,
mm-hmm.
we could say. And if you think of successful aquaponic systems, they're heavily stocked with fish. I mean, the bioload is incredible on those systems. But water changes are not part of the maintenance schedule. They're just not.
Is it because they're growing plants in it, so the plants are sucking everything up, right?
Right, that's part of it. And the fish are growing. The fish are reproducing. They're doing well. when the systems are functioning as they should, and they often do, you know, it's, mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're trouble-free all the time, but in general, the systems work, and they work well. And there are immense amounts of nitrifying bacteria, immense amounts of plant mass, and, of course, lots of surface area for the nitrifying bacteria and for the plant mass to grow in. And often composting worms are part of the system as well. And they're processing a lot of waste in the water. So the crud doesn't sit there. It's converted to plant mass. But even at a greater rate than it is in most planted tanks, because, like I said, the surface area is incredible. The plant mass, not only is it huge in comparison to most planted tanks, but it benefits directly from atmospheric CO2, because these are plants that are out in the atmosphere and pulling all the CO2 they want, mm-hmm. basically. So those systems work. The fish reproduce and then live and they grow. So
I don't remember. Is Dr. Bob's tank planted? I don't remember.
The 55 that you mentioned, yes. Okay. He's planting it with some of the native plants from his area.
Oh, right, because that's going to be his yep. native tank.
Yeah, and then here's another thing, too. There's probably a very big difference between a water change performed with a gravel vac in the substrate, because it's preferentially pulling...
Is that not...
crud.
I just kind of assumed that the guy whose name I can't pronounce, who wrote this article on the uh-huh. big water... He wasn't using a gravel vac? He's not accounting for that? Because who does a water change without a gravel vac?
Well... It has been done, and, you know,
it but also why depends on the system. Like, I guess if the planted tanks, you've got the...
Right.
But I don't know, I kind of assumed in my head, and that's me assuming, though, that he was accounting for that.
Well, he may have, and I don't actually recall in the article whether he mentioned that specifically or not. But the thing is, if you're assuming that every unit of water in the tank is the same, you can't really assume that if you're using a gravel bag, right? Because, like, when mm-hmm. I vacuum the goldfish tank...
Because then you're vacuuming
the... I go down to the gravel vac, and I'm pulling all this stuff out. And that's pulling a lot more crud out than if I were just randomly draining water out of the tank. So
he wasn't assuming using a gravel tank.
I just don't remember. I don't remember whether or not he was. But my point is that it does take a lot more crud out.
Yeah.
Crud that would otherwise be degrading in the water and causing problems. And in the same vein... If you are replacing your filter pads a lot more frequently, you're pulling mm-hmm. out a lot of stuff preferentially, a lot more concentrated than just removing water. And you need to be, you know, taking your filter pads out and rinsing them off or replacing them to get a lot of that crud out of the water. Because if you let it sit in the tank, in the filter, it's still in the water and it's still, you know, it's degrading in the water and it's contributing to a good decline in water.
Because the water's all running through it.
Right. So it's not equal. That's another point. And then to address Dr. Bob's question about treating large amounts of water for big water changes, the best systems that I've heard of, and really the only remotely practical way to do it, besides a flow-through system, which can be practical in some cases, like we talked to Ken Jones, the Prince of Ponds, about this. He had a flow-through system put in his mm-hmm. discus tank, and he just had a carbon block and an RO unit, and he...
It just has to be... You're not moving out of that house, and you have plenty of money.
He had to drill a hole in his wall and everything. It's kind of a...
It's a commitment.
It's a commitment, but it worked well for him. But anyway, mm-hmm. I'm getting on a tangent, aren't I? The only remotely practical way to do it is you get barrels, like the big blue 55-gallon barrels, the drums for water storage. Get something like that, or something like that. It doesn't have to be exactly that. And you put the tap water in it with a hose... And you treat it. Usually you put a pump or an aerostone in there to get it circulating, and you can put the dechlorinator in and stuff. And if you need to, you put a heater in, and you may or may not need to, depending on the situation. And then the water sits and outgasses with the pump running, and it gets mm-hmm. dechlorinated and everything, and temperature equalizes. And then you get a reasonably powerful pump if the barrel is lower than your tank level in your house,
mm-hmm.
and you just pump it up into your tank. If your tank level is lower than your bucket level or your barrel level, you just have to have, you can use a siphon or you can use a valve and just do it by gravity and put it in the tank that way. Now, there are lots of people that do it that way. So people with large tanks, when they do large water changes, that's the method I've heard from most of them.
they use. And I'm not saying that works for everybody. It might not work at all in Dr. Bob's situation because you have to have some place to put a 55-gallon drum.
Right.
And not everybody does.
Plus, even if you have a place to put it, then you have a 55-gallon drum sitting in your room.
Right. And
distracting from the beautiful fish tank.
And it depends on where you work, because a lot of people will keep it, the bucket, in a different room. Like, say, if their tank is downstairs in their basement, and the laundry room in, on the main floor has one of the 55-gallon drums in it.
Yeah.
Then it works, because gravity, you can use gravity to empty it into the tank, and you can use a hose to fill it up. It's not that bad. But, especially if you install a valve on it, so you just
attach a hose to it. You do have to have room for it.
Yeah, but you do have to have room for it, and, you know, everybody in the house has to be okay with it, and things like that. So, I haven't done it like that. I've done it on a much smaller scale with buckets and things, but I've never done the 55-gallon drum system. But if with a 55-gallon tank and a 55-gallon drum, you could do a large water change every week if you had that. Not to say that that is going to fit your situation, but it's the best, I think, that people
have done. But if you're not doing it, you're probably fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. We have lots of people who show, anecdotally at least, that fish can thrive at lower water changes, with fewer water changes or water changes of lower volume. Not to say that the big ones aren't beneficial, but can you have happy, healthy fish without them? In many cases, yes. Okay.
So don't stress over it.
All right, well, then let's go on to Dr. Bob's next.
Okay. The one from this week.
Yes.
He says, I believe that the sense of deja vu Kelly got last week when reading about having the heater set to 80 in my tank while it cycled was because Russ had suggested that I increase the water temperature to accelerate the bacterial growth. I was letting you know it was exactly what I did. I will try to do better in the future about noting my replies to your questions or suggestions.
Ah, I see.
For example, Russ suggested that if I still had the heater in the tank, I could use an assassin snail to rid the tank of other snails. In fact, prior to adding the fish, I removed the heater to bring the tank temperature down to about the 68-degree room temperature. However, a snail explosion isn't a problem yet. I'm hoping that it stays this way. As to your question about the darter fish, Kelly was right about the name reflecting the fish's movement. Oh, yay! Okay, I'm going to give a quote to you guys.
Don't worry, I won't let it go to my head.
A darter does not have a swim bladder that helps give most other fish zero buoyancy in the water column, so the fish tends to rest on the substrate on its pectoral fins that are oriented downward and swim forward in a darting motion. The other day I was thinking about microorganisms. They are a part of all the closed systems I maintain. My aquariums, of course, vermiculture and potted plants. I know that I need to treat my tank surfaces, substrate, and filter media like living things, gently and carefully cleaning them with only tank water and never tap water or gasp, soap or bleach.
That's how I feel about soap and bleach, too.
I began to wonder about my worm bins and potted plants, as they too depend on beneficial bacteria to function properly. Does chlorine and chloramine negatively impact those closed systems? A little research showed that soil-borne bacteria are killed by chlorine and chloramine, but the population rates are usually high enough to recover quickly. However, aquaponics and vermiculture specialists strongly advise RO or treated tap water for use in these applications to prevent the loss of beneficials. I think I will be hanging on to some of my siphoned off fresh water to water my potted plants and worm bins. I can't think of any negative to this practice, can you? As always, thank you for your ongoing help. I have enjoyed our interactions immensely.
Well, the feeling is mutual, and thank you. And I would like to say, in terms of using siphoned off water for your potted plants and worm bins, I think there's a lot of people who do it with positive results. I have done it. I think the only real negative that I can think of, potential negative that I can think of, is if you have a pathogen such as fish TB, the mycobacterium, in your water, that putting it in the soil or the worm bin, it's going to persist there. Most likely, if they're in large quantities. I mean, the likelihood is there are some of those environmental mycobacteria in your potted plant soil and in your worm bins just because they're everywhere. But that if you happen to have them, not to say that you do, but if you happen to have them in your tanks at pathogenic levels, then you would likely increase the proportions of those bacteria or the populations of those bacteria, rather, in those in the potted plants and in the worm bins. That's the only negative I can think of, but it's not necessarily the case because you'd have to have, you know, high concentrations of them in your tanks for that to be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't believe that even if you did, that it would hurt the plants. And I don't know what it would do with the worms.
What would it do if it were a food-producing plant?
I don't think, if it was on the roots or anything, if it were on the roots and you were eating the roots, that would be one thing. But say you put it on a tomato plant and you could still eat tomatoes, I don't think the mycobacteria would be up in the tomatoes.
So tomatoes might be fine, but maybe not carrots?
But even carrots, probably, if you wash them. I'm in speculation mode right now, so I don't know. But if you're just putting it on your house plants, the only difficulty I could foresee
is... Just your decorative house plants.
Right. Because most people don't grow food plants as house plants. But
I guess that's true.
If you are digging around in the dirt and you poke yourself and get some of the dirt in your finger, you might get fish handler's disease, you know. You get a little nodule that gets infected with fish TB. I mean, it's... Worst case scenario, if you had large populations in the soil and you poked yourself with a stick that's in the dirt or whatever, that could happen. I guess that's the only bad thing I could think of.
Okay. Here we go. So, thank you, Dr. Bob. And we are going to go to Anthony from Oregon.
Okay.
Have we heard from Anthony before?
Yes, we have.
Okay.
Recently.
Oh, okay. See... I don't know, I've been taking care of sick people all month. I had my brain shot.
And I've been
sorry, one of those Anthony.
Sick people all month. Yeah.
So he says, good day again, Aquarimax. I have 3 jeweled African cichlids and a blue fancy cichlid. One of the jeweled cichlids laid eggs in the night a week or so ago. Since then, they have eaten the eggs. But I was wondering, how can I figure out the sex of the cichlids so as to know if they even have a chance to propagate?
Okay. Well, first of all, cichlids, my first thought when I read this is thinking about cichlids in general, and there are some cichlids that are very dimorphic sexually, like cribs.
Mm-hmm.
You look at a male crib, you look at a female crib, they're completely different, pretty difficult to confuse, right?
Okay.
But then you've got Oscars or angelfish that are notoriously tricky to sex. It's just tough. And then you've got some fish that are somewhere in the middle. A lot of cichlids are somewhere in the middle. And I think jeweled cichlids are on the rather difficult side. I haven't kept jeweled cichlids before, but they are on the difficult side, but not impossible to figure out. One thing is to think about their fins. You know, the males tend to have slightly pointier fins, especially the terminal end of the dorsal fin towards the tail and the anal fin. You can look for pointiness. They're typically a little more colorful. They're a little longer in body proportions. The females are a little shorter, stubbier a little bit, and not quite as colorful. The males tend to have spangles, you know, they have the little jeweled dots, the little blue iridescent spangles near their gills that are brighter and so on. These are, some of these, I'm going specifically for jewel cichlids, and I had to look up more on jewel cichlids because I haven't kept them. But some of the first things that came to my mind were the finnage, you know, and the body shape, because that tends to be true for most cichlids. And then I looked up some things to confirm what my thoughts were, and those are some of the things they said. I'm going to put those websites, so the links to them, on the show page, so you can check those out yourself. And so you know I'm not claiming this as my first-hand knowledge. Because I do have first-hand knowledge with sexing cichlids, but not necessarily with jewel cichlids. So you can also look up venting, and that's something that's done with African cichlids a lot. And I'm reasonably sure that it would be helpful in terms of jewel cichlids also. But just don't be discouraged if your eggs got eaten the first time. It is, you know, as you pointed out, you don't necessarily know you have a male just because you have eggs, because sometimes a female cichlid will lay eggs by herself without a male around. Sometimes 2 female cichlids will both lay eggs. And I've even read about...
See, it's so hard to tell, they can't even tell.
Sometimes they can't tell, and sometimes a female cichlid will actually, I've read about this really, will produce enough sperm that she'll be able to fertilize some of the eggs.
Wow.
Because
Fisher
gender. Fluid.
It's just it's, they can change a lot of the time, and some of the cichlids do. And apparently a lot of cichlids are not chromosomally determined. They're whether they're male or female is determined by environment. And
interesting.
Like which other fish they encounter,
dominant males, or if
how much food they've eaten, this kind of thing can change whether or not. And so sometimes even as adults, they can be a little bit flexible. No, I'm not sure that all species can do that, but some of them can.
Hmm.
I read this study, I can't remember where it was, but they had two cichlids that were females, both laying eggs, but then one of them managed to fertilize like six of the eggs, and they hatched or something.
Wow.
It was crazy.
That's pretty amazing.
Anyway, but hopefully that helps. Check out those websites, the links that we'll put up on the show page, and hopefully that'll help. And just because they're eating, you know, most cichlids that I've had, the first time they lay eggs, they eat them.
Because they don't know what to do with them.
You don't get anything out of it at all. But then the next time, they usually do a little better, and the time after that, they do even better. They learn.
I'm glad people don't eat their firstborn because they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, that would be sad.
That would be messy. Okay, one more.
Mm-hmm.
Tony from New York. He says, thanks very much for taking the time to discuss a difficult topic with me on the podcast. It was definitely possible to clean out all the scum in the shrimp tank. A thorough cleaning of the filter, I used very hot water as a precaution, helped also. For now, everything seems to be in good order. Perhaps I have dodged a bullet, but I will be extra cautious with this tank until I have a better sense of this. Once the inhabitants, one shrimp and two snails, have lived out their natural lifespan, I will likely retire this tank and allow it to dry thoroughly before disposing of it. That may be overkill, but it seems a reasonable way to go at this time. He says, thanks so much, Russ. You've always been here for all of us when we really need you with good advice and the voice of fishy experience, too. May the fish be with you.
Well, thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. And just to respond to what you've decided to do with the tank, and you know, it's a responsible choice when you think you may have some pathogenic beasties there that are going to be hard to deal with to do that. So I can certainly respect the choice to decommission that tank when the time comes. I'm not entirely sure it's necessary. As you mentioned, it might be overkill, but at least, you know, you can make that choice and be safe rather than sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always good. One thing about cleaning out the filter, you, of course, will lose some beneficial bacteria, which can tip the balance because the mycobacteria tend to be opportunistic. And if the other bacteria are growing fast and in a healthy population, they tend to have low population. But if other bacteria get kicked out, then they will sometimes, you know, take over opportunistically when the environment, just like using a bleach solution in a tank, mycobacteria usually means you kill off most of the other bacteria and then they will kind of take over because they are resistant to bleach. So it's possible that that can happen, but I'm assuming because you have this nice planted tank that's been running for a while that your substrate and the plant surfaces, you mentioned that tank has a lot of Java moss in it and so on, are going to have a lot of good, healthy, happy bacteria on it that are going to help keep that more in balance. Because cleaning the filter off with hot water, of course, you're going to lose a lot of healthy bacteria, but if there are a lot of them in the rest of the tank, it shouldn't be so much of an issue. So, you know, and the shrimp might last, and the snail might last quite a while longer. Yeah. I mean, it seems like you mentioned your shrimp was pretty old, and they don't live that long, the red cherry shrimp. They don't live as long as the Amano shrimp, for example. But, which, incidentally, I saw our Amano shrimp again,
really?
Not too long ago, a couple of weeks ago, when I was doing a water change.
In the goldfish
Still
tank?
Still in the goldfish tank.
Oh, did we tell them about Paisho?
No, we didn't. We lost Paisho, one of our goldfish.
That was sad.
And I'm not even sure what it was from.
He wasn't doing very well since we moved.
I think the move was a little stressful for him. And he was just in decline. He didn't. Wasn't really symptomatic of any diseases. He didn't show any lesions or any things like that. And
he just
sort of
wasted.
Wasted, but not in a way that looked, you know, characteristic of anything that I could identify. But it was sad.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, and that's the tank we have the UV sterilizer on and everything. And
he didn't like dropsy out.
No,
like
he
the
didn't
other
do
ones
anything.
Anything.
No, like it didn't. That's what I'm saying. It didn't look symptomic of a whole lot.
I don't know what it is. But we had had him for a few years, but certainly not the lifespan of a goldfish. Mm-hmm. Just maybe 3 years or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Maybe not even that.
Maybe not even that. Maybe only two. So certainly he passed on early. Luckily, our other goldfish is doing very, very well. But I think that's about it for this week,
except,
isn't it?
Except. Can I ask my silly question?
Okay, sure.
Okay. I was going to tell you guys, I had this dream last night. I was walking on a school campus, and they had these areas that were supposed to be like ponds, except it was just a certain area in the air, and the fish were all swimming around in the air. And there was this one that looked like a basketball-sized blackamoor. And he really, it was like a little dog in his pond, and he, like, I was petting him, and he'd rub all over people, and just like a little dog. And it made me laugh when I woke up that I was having this fish dream. And so I was wondering if you guys have ever had weird fish dreams, you could send them in, and it might be kind of funny, so.
Well, I've had fish dreams where the fish are swimming in the air mm-hmm. a lot. Usually what happens is the fish suddenly realize they can swim in the air and they swim all over the house. They get out of the tank and I have to run around the house catching them all and putting them back in the tank. But when I do, they swim back out. So I've had a similar sort of dream. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that is kind of a fun question. So hopefully we'll get some responses on that one.
Yeah. Okay, now we're finished.
Okay. So may the fish
be with you.